Today's topic is five estate planning action items that remain relevant regardless of the shifting political winds. What does that mean, relevant, and what does it mean, shifting political winds? Number one is we've watched the estate tax ping-pong back and forth as to where the exemption is going to be. It's not so long ago that the estate tax exemption was $1 million, went to $3.5 million, then went up to $5 million. Then the threat was that it was going to go back to $1 million. Then from $1 million, it wound up settling at $5 million. Then Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton threatened to have the exemption go to $3.5 million after they were elected. And then Donald Trump got in and the exemption was to be wiped away completely and there'd be no tax at all. And then the Republicans, with Donald Trump leading that charge, settled on an exemption just a little over $11 million. In the meantime, income tax, or at least gains tax, during the Trump administration, suspended the age-old 15% and now is back at 20. And when you add the Obama or Medicare surtax, Medicaid surtax, your gains tax rates are over 30%. And, of course, income tax rates have continued to climb up during the Obama administration, and now we have seen some relief in some specific areas with respect to estate tax, income tax. As you know, in our income tax practice, we have commented that while some people are enjoying exemptions, others are not. And so, for example, the deductibility of income tax off your federal returns, the deductibility of property tax on your federal returns as well may net a lower number, at least for those of you on this call who are in from the Northeast. In the meantime, what should you be focusing on during periods of uncertainty? Well, one thing is for sure, with respect to certainty, we now believe that we've got top ticked and we're at the highest possible end on the estate tax amount. There are many who over the years did not suspend doing their estate planning, but privately sat in the corner on certain topics when they may have jumped in and said, I'm looking for a total relief on estate tax, that there would be none. This was a promise that George Bush said before the Obama administration. Now we know that at an $11+ million exemption times two at 22 with a husband and wife, during the period where the most aggressive effort combined with the executive branch being President Trump and the legislative branch being the House and the Senate, controlled by the Republicans, have achieved what we think is likely to be the highest exemption we're going to see in a long time. If they couldn't do it, the argument is nobody can. In the meantime, that exemption is still temporary in nature. So we can watch, and this preamble continues, where the exemption snaps back to $5.5 million or $5 million but indexed to inflation, number one. And number two, if the Democrats get in, both in and control the House and the Senate and the executive branch, we may see the exemption go back as low as $3.5 million. That was what Hillary and Bernie Sanders sought. And frankly, 99% of the population, or even very close to that amount, all depending on how you figure out a family's net worth, would already be free from estate tax when you bundle husband and wife and get them to 3.5 times 2, $7 million. So is it possible that they could garner enough political capital to reverse what Trump is and the Republicans have done? Well, indeed, they had the votes for it in the last election but did not win. I think we need to finish by saying, who knows? What direction are we going? But what should we be doing in the meantime? If this were a stock portfolio and you were sitting parked with a bunch of opportunities in cash, you would dollar cost average in because you don't know whether the market's going up or the market is going down. And so taking small bites into the market would enable you to begin to fully participate, but in the meantime, being able to bear the vicissitudes of the markets going up and down by going in for certain pieces. So what today is irrespective of what direction the estate tax exemption goes, what are the key things that you should be focusing on? Today, therefore, is not a tax planning day. Today is much more about things that you should be doing. So number one is to schedule routine checkups. Update your healthcare documents and your wills as well. So what do we mean by update? Well, first of all, consider whether the individuals named in your documents are still appropriate. Think about the positions, power of attorney, healthcare agent, guardian for minor children, trustees of an irrevocable or a testamentary trust, irrevocable made during your lifetime, testamentary trust made at your passing. Trust protectors, the people who have the right to change trustees or change jurisdictions. Trust appointers, the people who have the ability to modify powers in the trust, which can then have tax effects and very positive ones. So job one here is, has your relationship changed with any of your representatives, right? So it's easy to first say, well, if I'm married, it's my spouse. But who is behind your spouse? And are they in good health? And are they, if it's a guardianship, are they married? If they're not, if it's not a guardianship, then the next question is, who is behind your spouse if you're married, or who is your first? And look to your alternates and say, is my relationship as strong as it was? It's very common, and even in our own family, where we are confident in our first representative. But it's a toss-up who our second one is. And it's a toss-up because maybe it's their age. Maybe it's their geographic location. Maybe it's the relationship that you have with them. Maybe it's their health. So you choose one, but 1, 3, 5 years later, your alternate may not be as appropriate as your second choice, which is relevant. And the reason you say, well, I'm still protected with my first, well, indeed you are. However, if your first happens to become sick or is in the same car accident that you could be, and you don't have time to change your documents, it is why we have the alternate. So that you have somebody high quality. But we need to be respectful of the fact that alternates aren't often thought as closely as we should. And some of the biggest work we do is when you all come in and we address who the alternate is. So for sure, go through that list again, all right? Who you're making healthcare decisions for you? Who are your alternates? Are you, by the way, comfortable with your primary still? Who are your guardians? Who will serve to make business decisions? Your power of attorney, for example. Who are the guardians for your minor children? Who are the trustees of your trust and the alternate trustees? It's not uncommon to name your spouse if you're married, and of course that's some of the group who are on this call today, but who serves beyond the spouse? And if you're not married or widowed or confirmed single, in any of those issues, we need to think hard about both your primary and your alternate to make sure that you're clear in that position. Who would have the ability to remove the trustee? So often you'll ask this firm to serve as a trust protector or what we call a trust appointer who has the ability to inject certain powers into the trust that can have an important impact. It is critical that we continue to think that way. We are finding, and that has never been what we've solved for, but our clients are, and you folks on the phone have said, won't you serve as our trustee? Won't you serve as our executor? And we can bundle the work that you do, both the legal work and the fiduciary work, serving. So we take each one of those on an individual basis. We look at the length of our relationship, our ability to solve, our ability to help if there are could be jealousy or conflict among the children. But those are questions that are saved for meetings where we get together and truly discuss who is best for the family. And invariably, it has been family members with our advice. Number one is get the routine checkups. How frequently should you do routine checkups? Well, this is a sophisticated bunch that is on this call. And so we think while the typical prescription is 3 to 5 years, many of you have found value in meeting once a year, even if it's a half hour to an hour long. The value of that is, as you can see, sometimes traveling on the major highways, there are big placards or billboards saying, I spend more time in a month looking in my refrigerator at what to have for dinner, or on a Friday night, what restaurant to choose, or what movie to see with my loved ones, than I do on confirming that my retirement plan, in this instance, your estate plan, is in order. So we're more and more, those of you on this call have sophisticated circumstances where even the most nuanced tax or asset protection issue or even family representative can have a ripple effect of real significance to your estate. So please, we're reaching out to many of you. Please respond back to us just to have those quick reviews of representatives, where your estate is, where asset protection strategies are, and of course, even and is no less valuable, your philanthropic wishes, a big part of the work that we continue to do. Okay, so with respect to the amounts we're leaving to beneficiaries, are the amounts left to each beneficiary still appropriate? Well, if your portfolio is up a significant amount, and that could be a seven-figure amount over the previous years or eight-figure amount, but certainly a six-figure amount that has gone up over the past several years, do you want to change the amount that you're leaving to your list of beneficiaries? It's easy if you have three children, then it's equal shares, and then we have ability to adjust that with a power of appointment. But what if you're leaving specific gifts to siblings, to parents, to certain charities, to nieces and nephews? We feel a huge value in putting an actual number on that today. We always typically solve for having percentages, so with maybe a floor and a ceiling on how much to give to those loved ones. But when we are sitting and reviewing these numbers, we want to just put a big red pencil and say, you know, Cousin Sally is getting, under the current formula where your net worth is $50,000 or $50 million, is that a number that works for you here and now today? Well, that number has changed significantly. That's probably more than she needs. She's 5 years older than she was before. We want it to be a mere gesture of affection, or, you know, we've been closer than ever. We've actually thought about moving her as a guardian, and, you know, recent health matters. We want to times that by 10. Some of the biggest, best work we do, and often we'll say that person owes us a glass of champagne, and that being the beneficiary, when we sit down and we actually review the more subtle pieces, not the necessarily if there's a child in the picture or the significant other, those we are already solving for. But even the smallest amount of consideration is some of the, what I will call ancillary beneficiaries, either raising them up or not, or taking them off because there has been very little communication. Equally, what we want to do is for those family members who you're not in regular communication with, we want to make sure we know where they're located. So one of the biggest issues that Elizabeth, who runs our state administration practice group, many of you know her, and I have been confronted with in the past year, is an individual passed away leaving significant amounts to charity and some to family members. Well, we're not able to identify where some of those family members are located, and that presents significant challenges and, frankly, expense as we seek to hunt them down because they're not living in the community where their deceased aunt or their deceased uncle or their deceased sibling or cousin live. And so we want to be able to go down the list of family members and say, where is their most recent residence, so that we are closer to tracking. In the age of the speed of information flow, you would think more than ever we would know where everyone is at all times, and the answer is absolutely not. And sadly, it's usually those who have less assets and who need these assets and are there, were counting on their aunt to make that gift. But because they have less assets, they're less public in the way that they live their lives. Maybe they're not on Facebook. Maybe they don't even have a driver's license. Maybe their cell phone is the only number that they use. So it is important for us to identify who those relationships are and stay on top of them, on top of where their residencies are. Equally want to address, are they going through a divorce? So we've had people say, I'm leaving a portion to my sister, but now that she's getting divorced, I want to make sure that it's protected. I want to skip my sister and leave it to her children. I want to leave the amount to my sister in a trust because I don't want anybody but my sister to receive it. So going through the list of beneficiaries and confirming, number one, is the amount still right or do we need to change it? Is the relationship still what we've expected? Is it better or is it worse? Are they living near where we are that we can hunt them down? Do we have to worry about a tax to those assets? Should they be put into trust? So key things that are worthy of true consideration that may not have a real impact on taxation of your estate or even asset protection, but caring for, we gently would submit, some of the most vulnerable beneficiaries on your list who deserve the same love that you want to give to your primaries. Okay, number two is, and that will be the most we'll spend on time on any topic because it really could have been broken up into five, but we tried to keep today as a five topic matter, so that was one. Number two, do it for the kids. Set up trust for your children and grandchildren. So you all know that you can give away $15,000 a year. You also know that if married, there are two opportunities to give, which is between husband and wife. You also know that these gifts are cumulative but not compounding, meaning that once you give them, they all can accumulate inside the trust, but they cannot accrete if you fail to give. So if you haven't given a gift in the past 5 years, imagine and consider and focus on the fact that you need to be giving every year or you lose that opportunity. It is not unusual, for example, a new client, a new member to our family that you may have recommended, and it's a child or a sibling or a parent, where they'll say, oh, my goodness, I should be giving these gifts. You say, McManus, take these acorns out of my front yard and toss them into my kid's yard and put a fence around it so that it's out of my name, and one day those acorns grow into mighty oaks. That's true. I haven't done it. And so they'll call us in December, and we'll create a trust, and we'll move those annual exemption amounts into trust. And then January 1, we'll start all over again because we can do a second gift. Of course, the gift in January, the second gift, is far more powerful than the gift in December because the gift in January, you immediately seized on the $15,000 times $30,000 exemption. But you also got a full year of growth in those assets as compared to somebody who waits till the end of the year to make the gift, and they've actually only made a $15,000 gift. So the compounding that takes place over the course of the year is not insubstantial. Compounding. Tell me about compounding, McManus. So the answer here is once you put these assets into a trust, the trust will compound without tax because you, if properly drafted, are paying the tax on your children's trust or your grandchildren's trust. So you're seeing a growth inside that trust, which is far greater. There is no tax drag to slow down the yield on the compounding inside the trust. Stay focused on that piece because if you don't leave the assets in trust to your children and grandchildren, then they will not enjoy that compounding without tax. That will be an asset in their estate, and they'll have to pick up the tax. The trust gives you that privilege. But in addition to that, since the assets are in a protected vehicle, your child perish the thought experiences or grandchild a reversal in their life, a financial one, or they've been sued, or they're going through a divorce. In any of these instances, the key thing here is that we don't want to deprive those who are rightfully in charge of receiving their recovery to do so. That is what insurance is for, and frankly, maybe it's even what your children or grandchildren's assets are for within reason. But your asset that you've worked too hard for should not be the funding vehicle for somebody else and their lawyer to take away. And so leaving these assets in trust provides you with that unique opportunity. You can add a spouse onto your child or grandchildren's trust so that they can also receive assets if your child predeceases. You'll also have your child or your child's grandchildren be a beneficiary on that trust if your child or grandchild passes away. The key things, though, are that it is asset protected, that you get the gifts in and you're moving $30,000 a year on a compounding basis, that it's growing without any taxation, that you can then accelerate it. What we like to say is flatten the balloon out, slide it underneath the door, and then blow up the balloon on the other side. And now what you've done is taken advantage of getting under the exemption amount, under the door, and then watching the explosion of growth on the other side. Our best meetings are meeting with you all in our room, conference rooms, and celebrating the growth of your portfolio with your very capable financial advisors and seeing that these assets will not add to your estate, but in fact are asset protected and will be excluded from your estate. So keep that piece at the front end of your mind, which then allows us to move to the next part, which is moving assets off your balance sheet. So whether the tax rates are high, whether the tax rates are low, whether your assets are significant, whether your assets you feel are illiquid, the continued pattern of moving assets out of your name and into the next generation, irrespective of whether the garage door is three doors wide or it's just the side door on the side of the house, the pattern of giving is what is most important from a compounding basis. Give the amount that you feel comfortable with. Name your spouse as a discretionary beneficiary so that whatever you're giving in trust to your children, your spouse is the safety valve where you can then make a distribution out to your spouse if you feel the assets you need, the assets you've given away, or if you feel the compounding you should participate in. Giving a portion of the family business is key. All too often, it is that asset that is the single largest asset in the family and in the end is generating such significant income that it's disproportionate to the others. And God forbid you pass away and you're in a situation where we have to pay an estate tax. So even whether it's giving a piece or selling a piece into your children's trust is not something to look away from. For example, some of you have said, well, listen, if I give my business away, so I give away my income. If I give away my apartment building with 100 units that's generating $500,000 of net income for which I live on, when I give that building away, then so does the income go. Well, that allows us an opportunity in any tax climate to consider, and that is consider selling the apartment building to your children's trust and letting the income in that apartment building be the funding to pay off the note. So if I own a building that's worth $10 million and the income is $500,000 and I sell it to my children because of discounting, we can maybe get that value down because of illiquidity and lack of control. Maybe an appraiser will call it $8 million. So we sell the building to our children for $8 million. And on an annual basis, they take the $500,000 of income that now that the trust has to pay us off over the next series of years. Maybe it's just a small piece of the building we sell. But in any event, taking these illiquid income generating assets and moving them into trust for the children is a key way to just methodically move the assets off, irrespective, again, if the garage door is three doors wide or it's just a side door on the house that you just have a small opportunity. Seize it and continue the pattern of steadily doing this work. Okay, number four, make the switch. Swap assets out of your trust with other assets. So what does this mean? Well, any assets that you move into trust, the basis for tax purposes carries over. So if I sell an apartment building that we owned or a business that we own and depreciated, when we sell it to the children, there's no tax event there, but with the children continue to receive our original tax basis. And so that means if they're ever selling that building or that business, they'll have to pay the gain tax that we all would be paying if we sold it ourselves. Now, the good news is, since it's inside a trust, you all will pick up the tax for that portion of the company that the children have because of the defective nature of the trust. However, maybe you don't want to sell the business, but maybe the business will be sold after you pass away. Well, today, depending on the size of your estate is under $11 million, or husband and wife, $22 million, you're saying to us appropriately, hey, McManus, you and your team moved all these assets into trust. Now the basis is the same as what it would be for me, but if I kept those assets in my name, at the time I passed away, basis for income tax purpose would get reset to the value of the asset when I pass away. And of course, as you know, if the basis on a $10 million asset is $2 million, because we've depreciated the equipment and other discounted other assets, today if we sold it, we'd have an $8 million gain, and at a 30%+ rate, we're talking $2.5 million or near that. We lose that window because we've given it to the trust. Now, you were solving, McManus, to get into the trust for asset protection purposes. You were solving because you wanted that asset out of our estate for estate tax purposes. But hey, McManus, those days are over. We no longer have an estate subject to estate tax. So this is when we grit our teeth and say, yikes, where are we on this? And so the idea here is, now what if I could take the piece of the business or the piece of real estate that I put into the trust and move it out of the trust and bring it back into your estate? Of course, if we do that, then it's a distribution back. But what if we just swap the asset, creating an even exchange? So I took cash or securities and I swapped that into the trust for the business asset coming back to me. Well, when I get that asset, and if I pass away, all of that business asset now gets a step up in basis. And since we're under the $11 million exemption, we don't have any estate tax, so we're getting our cake and we're eating it too. Because here we're avoiding estate tax and our biggest asset is getting the step up in basis. In the meantime, those assets that we moved out of our name many, many years ago grew, and we swap those assets back into the estate for some other asset that goes inside of the trust. It is not uncommon for clients of ours also to swap assets because they say, I have a handful of little lottery tickets, private equity opportunities. I put in 50 or 100 or 200, and eight of them are not working, but two of them we think could be 10 times what we originally invested. So maybe, McManus, you have a bunch of securities, some of my business interests in the trust, but what we'll do is we'll swap those lottery tickets and those private equity opportunities into the trust, and we'll take back some of the low basis stuff that's in our name. Swapping is an important continued effort year in and year out to do the analysis in swapping. You need to look at basis. You need to look at where future growth is. You need to look at liquidity and whether these things are necessary, but you need to look regularly at these assets. And with our income tax practice, we're constantly crisscrossing on the income tax value versus the estate tax value. together with the biggest firms who are doing the powerful logarithms on what the calculations can be for taxes and growth on the portfolio. But don't doubt for one second that that piece is key. Last on the list is giving precedence to giving back. So many of you have created foundations, and several years ago that became my most significant initiative at the firm with all the other pieces that we're doing, both spending time in charity, giving back time with experience that we have, participating in making charitable gifts, number two. Number three, assisting others with creating foundations, charitable entities, where they're taking assets and moving them into their foundation for the growth that they receive without tax, but also making gifts on an annual basis, as you know, with the 5% annual gift distribution from the trust. So all of those structures have worked wonderfully. We're doing charitable trusts where you're basically taking assets and the high basis assets and wanting to liquidate them but not pay the tax. So the gains would be avoided by putting it into a charitable trust, but you'll receive the income stream for a period of years. And then at the end, the remainder will go into trust into the foundation you've created, or over the series of years leading up to it, income would generate and go into the foundation. So there are two ways that these tax-saving vehicles work. One, each way you contribute the assets into the trust. In one instance, you then, in all instances, you would liquidate the positions, pay no tax, get a tax deduction up front, and then either income from that trust annually would go into the foundation, or you would receive the remainder of your loved ones at the end, or you would enjoy the income now because you're looking for it, and then at the end there would be the remainder for the foundation. In either of these instances, we're seeing great good work, both from a tax planning standpoint, from a diversification of assets standpoint. Sometimes folks are, and very appropriately and adroitly, are using the income stream from the charitable remainder trust to pay for life insurance. And that would be in a trust and pass tax-free to the children. So these are key strategies that under any tax climate are working. But part two here is now we're spending time guiding you all, sitting on your foundations, teaching you ways to be philanthropic, helping you raise your children and your grandchildren in a culture of philanthropy, having annual meetings, discussing each of their favorite charity that they would like to both give time and talent, which they're accustomed to. But now, with this foundation, you're giving them the opportunity to take one of their favorites and give a portion of treasure. And so some of our most significant wins in the past 12 months have been convincing clients to give to the natural disasters we've seen. New York Times did a piece on us in December, but many of them have focused on giving gifts to places like Texas, to the south coast of Florida, west of Miami, rebuilding homes after the natural disasters. Of course, Puerto Rico and in the Caribbean, and then even on the West Coast with the fires they've had. It is wonderful to create the structure. It is even more fulfilling when this structure now is generating a largesse for your favorite charities. So this piece is a critical, annual, continued focus that you can continue to be doing, and we're privileged to be with you. So with that, five quick thoughts and ideas that would show you there is a compelling need to meet, chat, to spend a little time, and to continue this focus in this climate of uncertainty. We do have a certainty, and that is continuing your estate plan.